Job number one this morning.
Create more jobs.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Thanks for checking out the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. It is Monday, June 13th, 2011.
Welcome back, Steve.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Coming up, the IMF now has two searches on its plate, one for new leadership and one for hackers.
China wants to cool its economy, but could it go too far?
And men love their cars apparently more than themselves. All that coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
President Obama heads to North Carolina today to visit a high-tech lighting company that's actually been creating a few jobs in the down economy. That is a trick the president would like to pull off on a national scale.
And as he hits the road, he's getting two different roadmaps for job creation. Marketplace's Jeff Horwich starts us off with the details.
First, you've got the safe, low-hanging fruit approach. That would be the recommendations from the President's Jobs and Competitiveness Council. The group of CEOs, labor leaders, and academics recommends a slate of quick, cheap tweaks that don't require any help from Congress. Faster permits for construction, more help with small business loans, a simplified visa process to allow more tourists to come here and spend money. Harvard economist Ken Rogoff says it's sensible stuff.
We're talking about things like reducing red tape, making homes more energy efficient. These aren't big macroeconomic policies.
Then you've got ex-economic advisor Larry Summers with the go big or go home approach. Summers wants to extend the payroll tax cut for another year and pour more money into infrastructure projects. MIT economist David Autor says it's less about the specific spending and more about just spending.
The hope would have to be that it would just be the sort of general macroeconomic stimulus, spend a bunch of money, gets the pumps flowing, etc.
The final tab for the Summers proposal, $300 billion. I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace.
Let's get some analysis now from Julia Coronado. She's chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas. And she's with us every Monday. This morning, she joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Julia, what do you think about what Jeff was just talking about? Would these ideas spur job growth at this point?
Well, I mean, I think the piecemeal, the low-hanging fruit approach certainly could help some things at the margin. I think the Summers proposal, you know, I think we have to be careful here. We've tried a lot of these quick fixes, stimulus approaches that really haven't produced much. I think some of the issues we're facing are a lot more structural in nature.
So would you, if you were advising the president this morning, would you just say, just sit back, don't do anything? What would your advice be?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, I think there's so one of the things that policymakers can do is help reduce some of the fundamental uncertainties. So the Congress and the president have been haggling over the debt ceiling and the deficit issues. There's issues around the implementation of Dodd-Frank. There's issues around implementation of the health care reform. The sooner we get bipartisan concrete proposals that address these fundamental policy issues, the less uncertainty there is for businesses and consumers, and the more they can just sort of get back to work. And I think that is something the president could do that would be much more important on a longer-term basis.
And does it matter what the outcome of those arguments are, or is it just, do you just have to reduce the uncertainty and go one direction or the other, or is business concerned that it'll go the wrong way?
Well, I mean, clearly you do have to make the right decision. And I think, for example, on the budget deficit issue, there's a general sense that what you want to do is address some of the longer-term structural issues, but you don't necessarily want to bring the hammer down on the economy in the near term, given the fragility of the recovery. So I think if they can implement some of these longer-term issues to address the longer-term budget deficit, that would help the uncertainty, because it is true that uncertainty in and of itself just leads people to put off decision-making, and that hurts the economy.
Julia Coronado, chief economist with the investment bank BNP Paribas, thanks so much as always.
It's my pleasure.
News this morning that the roast beef sandwich chain Arby's is being sold off to a private equity firm in a deal worth $430 million. Wendy's Arby's Group has been trying to get rid of Arby's since January.
Well, the latest Hollywood spectacle, Super 8, opened over the weekend, and its $37 million take is being described here in Los Angeles anyway as only mildly super.
And we've got more numbers anytime at the numbers section of Marketplace.org. Now the Marketplace Global Perspective. Indonesia is the latest country and the first big developing economy to throw its weight behind French Finance Minister Christine Lagarde to head the International Monetary Fund.
You know, we've been tracking for weeks the importance of that position to the global economy. But today the IMF is also trying to secure its huge database after a report that it was hacked. From London, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard.
The IMF has confirmed that earlier this year it detected suspicious file transfers on one of its computers. Cybersecurity experts are saying this was malware at work. Hackers had apparently planted software inside the IMF system for the purpose of stealing information. As the world's largest financial organization and lender of last resort, the IMF has plenty of valuable data. Peter Summer is a professor at the London School of Economics.
They have a huge amount of information about economies that are failing, and that is of great value to the financial institutions of the world, but also to the nation states who want to know what they're in for.
A country seeking a bailout, for example, might want to know in advance what the conditions will be. Security experts say a nation state is most likely to be behind the cyber attack, but proving which country was involved would be difficult. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's word out of China today that big banks handed out fewer loans in May, perhaps a sign that Beijing's effort to cool an overheated economy are making some headway. But how cool is too cool?
Michael Pettis is an economist at Peking University in Beijing. Hi, Michael.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Is there a risk that the Chinese government will overreach and hinder the country economically or even cause a slowdown?
Inevitable. What we've been growing extremely rapidly over the last 30 years because of huge increases in investment. And there's increasing evidence that 5 years ago, perhaps even 10 years ago, a very large amount of this investment was being misallocated. It was being used to build excess real estate development or excess infrastructure. And one of the consequences is that we've been seeing a very rapid rise in debt. And I don't think we can do this many more years before we run into real trouble.
How has China avoided the economic downturn the rest of the world's experienced?
Well, it hasn't really avoided it. What it did was it postponed it. They responded to the 2007-2008 crisis by taking a country which already had the highest investment growth rate in history and significantly increasing it. Now, when you increase investment, you always get growth. But if the investment is not economically viable, you give back all of that growth in the future. And I'm afraid that's what may have happened here.
Michael Pettis, economist at Peking University in Beijing. Michael, thanks.
Thank you.
There is a big meeting going on in London today that's all about helping children in poor countries get life-saving vaccines.
The government there in the UK and billionaire Bill Gates have pledged more than $2 billion to the Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, or Gavi. And Gavi is hoping the U.S. will pony up some money for the cause as well. Reporter Christopher Worth has more.
Pneumonia and diarrhea are the two biggest killers of children in developing countries. They're preventable, but vaccines cost money. And Nina Schwalbe, Gavi's managing director for policy, says the alliance is looking to donors to cover a big shortfall in its budget.
We need to raise $3.7 billion so that we can immunize 250 million children over the next 5 years and save 4 million lives.
Schwalbe says Gavi uses that money in innovative ways to get the job done. For example, because donor funds come in slowly in installments, Gavi has sold around $3.5 billion in bonds backed by past pledges, so it doesn't have to wait for the money.
Having the cash now means we can purchase the vaccines and vaccinate kids now.
James Hargreaves of the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine says Gavi is also trying to get the newest and most advanced vaccines to poorer countries faster. So Gavi created what it calls an advanced market commitment to get those vaccines to countries that can't afford them.
The advanced market commitment is an attempt to incentivize those companies by assuring that there will be a pot of money to purchase these products in the long term.
In other words, if drug companies make the vaccines, Gavi has promised to buy them. It started with vaccines for pneumonia, which Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline already sold in the U.S. and Europe. Gavi got them to ramp up supplies for the developing world within a year by setting aside $1.5 billion to cover the costs.
That's huge money.
Daniel Berman of Doctors Without Borders takes issue with the idea. He says the companies were already making billions of dollars selling the vaccines in rich countries.
You really have to scratch your head when you think, why do they need a subsidy to sell to poor countries?
Instead, he says Gavi's money would be better spent helping drug makers from emerging markets to develop vaccines at a fraction of the price. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg wants a bigger bang for his buck, Steve. According to the New York Times, the mayor wants the city's street sweepers to double as parking enforcers. Theory is they're driving around anyway. Why not just, just keep an eye out for illegally parked cars? Well, the street sweepers would not actually give out tickets, though. It turns out that they would have these cameras installed on them. They would take pictures of the cars, and then they would send you a nice note in the mail that said, you owe us $65.
It would be funny if they gave, if Mayor Bloomberg gave the meter maids like brooms.
Goes both ways. What I was thinking is, what if you get one of those tickets that says, that has a photo of your car and says you owe $65, yeah, could you send back in a picture of $65?
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at marketplace.org.
It's been nearly a year since Wall Street regulations were signed into law. Some of those Dodd-Frank regulations are just now seeing the light of day, like new rules requiring big banks to come up with a living will in case financial trouble strikes again. Fortune Magazine's Alan Sloan is here to talk about those wills this morning. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
Now, I thought wills were for people. I mean, why are financial institutions having to draw up living wills?
Well, because just like a living will is for a person saying, here's what to do if I get sick, the giant financial institutions are supposed to give regulators a plan to take care of the institutions if the institutions get sick.
Now, what if the banks don't comply with that? I mean, or they're not able to put a working, livable will together?
After three tries, in theory, the regulators, the FDIC and the Federal Reserve, could seize the banks, sell off their pieces, liquidate them. In reality, I can't imagine this will ever happen, but in theory, that's what would happen.
I'm curious, what should the federal government have done instead, Alan, to ward off the dangers of a financial collapse?
The whole purpose of living wills is to take care of institutions that are too big to fail. And we saw what happened, yeah, when you have those. What the government should have done was break up the institutions, which no one in Washington had the nerve to do, or to separate the parts of the institutions involving federal deposit insurance from the more go-go risky parts, so the go-go risky parts could fail and leave the rest intact. But nobody wanted to do that, so they came up with the magical solutions of living wills, which seemed to solve the problem at no political expense.
Now, if there is such a worry, Alan, that these big banks are too big to fail, why does the government let them get so big?
Well, clearly, Steve, you don't understand the market system. Do you remember? There was a market system. The banks would all take care of themselves because it would be in the interest of their shareholders to be prudent. So they were going to be prudent until one day they weren't, and now you and I get to pay for it. Isn't life wonderful?
It is wonderful, especially for a Monday morning. Alan Sloan joining us from New York. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
There's new data from the Chronicle of Higher Education on how many members of state legislatures went to college. 75%, it turns out, have earned at least a bachelor's degree. But do those diplomas make them better lawmakers? We sent Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer to find out.
Democrat Emily Kane has served in Maine's legislature for 7 years. She has bachelor's and master's degrees in education and is now working on a PhD. She says her higher learning helps her think critically, especially when she's presented with research or statistics.
Who collected the data? Was it an organization with an agenda?
But you don't have to be a pointy head to be a good state legislator. Sometimes it helps not to have a degree. Scott Smallwood is managing editor of the Chronicle of Higher Education.
But there's a strong history in America of not wanting to be governed by a sort of specialized elite.
Smallwood says only a little more than a quarter of all Americans have college degrees. Lawmakers without degrees say they understand their constituents' problems better than Ivy Leaguers. In fact, the Chronicle found some lawmakers who touted their lack of formal education, saying they went to the School of Life or gun school. But from where I sit in Washington, D.C., about one of every 30 congressmen went to Yale. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Nokia is about to lose its spot as the world's top-selling mobile phone maker. Not to Apple, though, to Samsung. Nokia has been the leader in cell phone sales. I didn't know this, Jeremy, since 1996.
Yeah, isn't that unbelievable? With those simple little cell
phones.
Remember
them, yeah. And that was 2 years before Apple even started putting the letter I in front of its new product names.
That was
I
long those days time too. Ago.
Apple, by the way, is also forecast to pass Nokia later this year.
That does not surprise me at all. Facebook, though, Steve, this is a surprising story, just lost a few faces.
Mm.
6 million users in the U.S. actually ditched their Facebook accounts last month, and the number of people using the site during the month of May also fell in Canada, Russia, and the UK. This is according to new data from the company called Inside Facebook, and the BBC's Rebecca Singer has our story.
Facebook is still racking up users in new markets like Mexico and Brazil. But according to this data, it seems that once half of a country's population is logged into Facebook, the social networking site stops growing. Chris Green is a technology industry analyst at Davis Murphy Group. He says that makes up most of the core market.
If you think about it, around about half the population, a little bit more, a little bit less, depending on where you look, will comprise of those between about 16 and 60. Anything outside of that, or those really too young to either use the service or to actually appreciate and understand it.
But don't write off further expansion in the countries where it was first successful. Green says although Facebook isn't actively reaching out to older users yet, the over 60s are increasingly being drawn in by the big advertisers, who are intentionally trying to bring older users onto the site because they have so much spare cash. In London, I'm the BBC's Rebecca Singer for Marketplace.
And finally, a new study confirms, Jeremy, men care more about our cars than we do about our bodies. I don't know if you're like this. Sometimes I think like this myself. In a survey by the Men's Health Network in Abbott Laboratories, nearly 70% of men said they find it easier to maintain their cars than they do their own personal health.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. 40% said they were more likely to take that car in for a checkup than they were to take themselves to the doctor.
Well, you got to make sure that things are running well in the car, you know?
Well, I know, but how are you going to be driving if you're dead?
That's
you know?
A good point.
You're not going to be going anywhere in that Mustang or whatever it is, whatever car you're driving. You know, but it would make things so much simpler if we were born, like, with some instrument cluster or gauges, you know, to figure out whether you're running a little hot or whether you're out
there
of gas.
There you go. Hey, you know, we're all moving towards Androids these days, so maybe soon we will. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. Enjoy your Monday. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.